From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, my conversations with two extraordinary men and their amazing stories. First, we'll hear from Des Moines adventurer Charlie Whitmack. He'll tell us about completing the first leg of his world triathlon when, on Sunday, he swam the English Channel, becoming the first American to swim both the Channel and summit Mount Everest. Later in the hour, we'll listen back to a conversation with Kevin Connolly. Connolly is a photographer who was born without legs. He writes about his experiences growing up in his memoir, Double Take. Connolly has traveled the world on a skateboard and is an X Games ski champion. We get started right after this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today a conversation with two extraordinary men and their amazing stories. One who has achieved a feat only a handful have ever attempted, and the other who has overcome a disability that has allowed him to travel the world on a skateboard. But first, a conversation with Charlie Whitmack of Des Moines. Whitmack is on an 11,000-mile world triathlon adventure spanning 13 countries. On Sunday, Whitmack swam the choppy waters of the English Channel, and in doing so, became the first American to complete what is known as the Peak and Pond, the name given to the task of climbing Mount Everest and completing the Channel swim. Whitmack climbed Mount Everest in 2003 and will attempt the feat again as the last leg of his world triathlon adventure. I spoke with Charlie Whitmack earlier this week after his successful swim of the English Channel and asked him about accomplishing this feat despite a case of mild pneumonia.
And my lungs are filled up with fluid right now, and we're not certain exactly what it is, but it's the result of swimming, you know, 8 to 10 to 12 hours a day in the sea. You pick up a lot of sea foam, and that ends up in your lungs.
So you've got sea foam in your lungs.
Yeah, that's it. You pick up a lot of water and salt water, and it just ends up where it shouldn't be.
Uh-huh. I thought you were joking with me to begin with, but I guess you're not. Dr. John Quinn of Des Moines is with you. He was on the escort boat, I understand. You do have some mild pneumonia, though, I understand, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just it's fluid in the lungs is really what it is, and it has slowed me down, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Why not wait and get healthy before swimming?
Well, the problem is it's gotten worse every day. So the amount of time that it's going to take to clear up was longer than what we had for weather here. We had a very good day on Sunday, and it looked like it was going to be the only good day for a long period of time. And so that was our opportunity. We just had to go for it.
How do your lungs feel now?
Yesterday, recovering from the Channel, I was pretty winded and having a hard time even walking up and down the stairs. Today, I'm feeling a little bit better, and I think tomorrow, hopefully, I'll be ready to get on a bike and bicycle to India.
Okay, we'll talk about that a little bit later in our conversation. But first, let's talk about the swim, this magnificent feat you just accomplished. Began in England on Sunday, 11 hours, 58 minutes later. You came ashore just south of Calais, France. What will stand out as the highlights of the nearly 12 hours of swimming? Heck, it's only 2 minutes short of 12 hours. We'll call it 12 hours of swimming.
No, it's a funny thing because you're so isolated as a swimmer. And I'd been doing it, you know, for almost 5 weeks now. I think today is actually the sixth week of the expedition. And so I'd gotten used to spending all day long in a very enclosed, constricting environment with my head in the sea. And so the things that stick out are simple things. You know, I would have a feed every 45 minutes. Usually once in between those feeds, I would pass over a jellyfish, and I would watch it as it swam by me, hope that I didn't get stung. And then, you know, on every breath, I would look up, and my wife was sitting there on the railing of the boat. You know, she had a bright red jacket on and usually a smile and a blue scarf. And so that was pretty much it. It was a very simple day.
Well, so the people on the boat could shout encouragement. You could talk to them at times? No, yes.
Well, I have to swim with earplugs in because the water's so cold. If it gets in your ears, it does affect you, and it actually brings down the temperature of your brain. So we swim with earplugs, and that pretty much prohibits anybody from talking to you. But you can see them, and they're waving and smiling and giving you thumbs up and things like that, so it is encouraging.
Hmm. You swim the entire 12 hours, or do you stop and float and rest?
Well, one of the rules with channel swimming is that you can't ever touch anyone, nor can you touch the boat. So the other thing is the tides are very, very strong in the English Channel, so if you stop moving, usually the tides start pushing you in the wrong direction. So you try to feed in about a minute to a minute and a half, and that's considered kind of a long feed. So for the first 3 hours, you just have a feed every hour. And then after that, most swimmers take a feed every 30 minutes. I like to go a little longer, so I took my feeds every 45 minutes, and then that's all you do. So every 45 minutes, you stop for about a minute. You try to chug 20 ounces of high-carbohydrate drink, maybe have a ho-ho and a bite of banana, and then carry on.
So do they reach this down to you on a pole? Do they throw it to you on a rope? What do they do?
Yeah, the water bottle comes in tied to a rope, and the food comes down stuck to the end of a pole. And remember, you're out in the sea, so the waves, you know, the swells are 8 to 10 feet high, so it's a little bit of a trick actually catching the food or the drink. And then it's a real trick trying to sit there and tread water and actually get it in your mouth and get it down. And so usually, you know, the minute passes pretty quickly, and you're frankly looking forward to be back swimming because that's a whole lot easier than trying to get nutrition.
Okay, so you have a feed, as you say, every few hours. You're monitoring your body, I imagine. Are you worried about cramping up, I imagine?
Yeah, the cramps are pretty bad. You know, there's a variety of things that can happen in the English Channel, and the most serious, the one that got me in 2008, was hypothermia. And so the crew's watching for hypothermia. They're, you know, watching the swimmer, asking questions periodically, making sure that you're still cogent, you still understand where you are, you understand who you are, you understand what you're doing. They watch your hands. You know, when you start getting cold, your hands will get stuck in a claw position. Your skin changes colors from red to blue to white. And to keep an eye on those kinds of things. You know, next, the next most serious thing is actually a pulmonary edema. That's a swimming-induced pulmonary edema. And that's just you get so much fluid on the lungs from breathing in that salt water and that sea foam that your lungs start to pile up, and that can get pretty dangerous. The pneumonia is an issue, and the symptoms like that can look like swimming-induced pulmonary edema. And, you know, nausea, there's viruses you can pick up. There's a whole bunch of other things that can happen along the way, but those are the major ones.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to picture this. So you're swimming there, earplugs, so you're not hearing much. The sloshing of water, perhaps, and the gurgling that you would hear in water and your own swimming motion. You're looking up, seeing your wife on deck of the boat in her bright jacket. What's going on in your mind? What are you thinking about most of the time in the 12 hours?
You know, the most important thing with endurance sports is to actually try to stop thinking. If you start thinking anything beyond just the next stroke, it gets pretty difficult to keep that up. France is an impossible distance away. You know, at any point you've already swum what you would believe to be an impossible distance, and it just is hard to keep going on at all. So you try to enter a meditative state, stay calm, stay positive, stay in that instant, and just keep moving forward.
Mm-hmm. You know, Charlie, I'm sure you caught the press reports. They ask astronauts about this these days, so I'll ask you, too, because you're talking about having a feed. What about on the other end of things when nature calls?
Yeah, well, you know, we call it big business and little business, and you can take care of your little business in a swimsuit just fine as you're swimming, but the big business has to wait. So most of the diet, you know, is a liquid diet on something like this. And so you just do it as you need to, and you keep moving.
Okay. Now, you mentioned jellyfish. Are those the greatest dangers to a swimmer out there? Any other sea life to worry about?
You know, there isn't a lot of sea life in the channel. And the jellyfish during the channel crossing itself were minimal. I was surprised. A few days earlier, I had swum the longest distance I swam during the swim leg of this triathlon was a 24-mile day. And on the last couple of hours, I swam into a portion of the sea that was absolutely just filled with jellyfish. And in the course of an hour, I took probably 10 jellyfish stings. One of the jellyfish was so big, it actually covered my entire face. Mm. It stung me from the top of my forehead down across my nose and to my chin. Another one got stuck in the collar of my suit and just stung me continuously for about 10 minutes. But in the channel, you know, there were no jellyfish things. Honestly, I probably would have welcomed them because the pain would give you something else to think about, you know, but I wasn't that lucky.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, my guest, this is a conversation with Charlie Whitmack, a Des Moines adventurer, 33 years old, and on Sunday he became the first American to swim the 21-mile English Channel and climb Mount Everest, which he did not also on Sunday. That would be asking a little bit too much, wouldn't it, Charlie? Back in 2003, he summited Everest as the first Iowan to do so. Only three others in the world have accomplished this peak and pond exercise, one of the crown jewels in the adventure world. I'm thinking about this. You are now, there are only three others in the world who have accomplished this this feat called, I understand, the Peak and the Pond, climbing Mount Everest, summiting Mount Everest, which you did in 2003, and then also swimming the English Channel. You're the first American to do both. You know, having met you, having stood beside you, shook your hand, had a look at you, you look like a mountain climber. You're an athletic, you're an athletic, wiry guy. Are you going to take offense at that? Not wiry.
No. I always joke. I mean, I'm 5'7" and I weigh 145 pounds soaking wet, and I don't even know if I look like a mountain climber. I think I most people are surprised when they meet me how small I am and very small stature. I'm built more like a Sherpa than anything else. So yeah, it is unusual.
Having interviewed endurance swimmers before, long distance swimmers before, you know, it helps to have extra body fat for buoyancy and for insulation. So you're not really built as a swimmer, are you?
I think years ago after I climbed Everest, I think the week before, yeah, Lynn Cox was on your program the week before I was, and she had swum to Antarctica.
Right, right.
And she does have more of a strategy, you know, like a cold water mammal and a lot of body fat. You know, women are the best channel swimmers because they do have more body fat and they are a bit more buoyant. Everybody down on Swimmers Beach, 20, 30 or more percent body fat, that's really going to be a big advantage. So, you know, I have about 4% body fat. It's very, very low, actually dangerously low. And I really struggle to keep on body fat, so hypothermia is a major issue.
So, and this was no doubt a contributing factor to you nearly freezing to death on your first attempt across the channel 2 years ago, hypothermia. Now, what did you learn from that attempt that you then changed, did differently, were watchful of this time?
Well, the project on now is the World Triathlon, and this is the project I've been working on for literally 19 years. And so as part of the training for this project, of course, I bicycled a lot. I climbed Mount Everest. I worked on the channel swim. And so in 2008, my hope was to be able to swim the English Channel without the help of a wetsuit. And so I made the attempt. I made it about 15 miles. My doctor at the time pulled me out of the water, and I was unconscious, and I was literally close to death. So what I realized in that, I came back. I had some physiological testing at Des Moines University. And we just realized that my physiology wasn't going to allow me to put on the body fat necessary to stay warm in the water. So I did wear a wetsuit this year. Now, in open water swimming circles, wetsuits are not permitted. Open water swimming is a historic sport. And as Lynn Cox did when she swam in Antarctica, you know, she didn't have anything but her body fat to keep her warm. So there's another association called the Channel Crossing Association, and that was the group that supported me this time and ratified my swim, and we did it under triathlon rules. So because this is a triathlon and a swim leg, I was wearing a wetsuit during the crossing.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Des Moines' Charlie Whitmack, who is in Europe in the midst of an 11,000-mile world triathlon adventure spanning 13 countries. I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Let's get back to my conversation with Charlie Whitmack. The Des Moines resident is in the midst of an 11,000-mile world triathlon trek across 13 countries.
Now, when you start, I understand you're going to start fairly quickly the second leg of your triathlon, the biking to India from France to India. When do you start?
Tomorrow morning, yeah, about 5 a.m. I'll jump on the bike here and get started.
So on what day of the week?
That'll be Wednesday. Yeah, tomorrow's Wednesday.
Okay, so by the time this airs, you will already be biking from France to India. Describe the route you'll take.
We're going to start at the beach where I landed, finishing the English Channel swim. It's called Cap Grenet, just to the south of Calais, France. I'll cycle up the coast of France to Dunkirk, and then finally into Belgium and Brussels, and then down the Rhine Valley of Germany, across to the Czech Republic and Prague. Then up across Poland, then finally Ukraine, Russia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, China, Tibet, Nepal, finishing in Calcutta, India.
I'm tired just listening to that list. What do you expect to be the most challenging stretches?
You know, the bicycle ride is just to be epic. I couldn't be more excited. We're going to be crossing the Torgart Pass between Kyrgyzstan and China. It's one of the highest mountain passes in the world with a road on it. Road is sort of a loose term there. It's actually snow and ice covered. It's a glacial, a road that goes across a glacier. And then dropping down over the Himalayas there into the Taklamakan Desert in China. The Taklamakan Desert will involve an 1,100-kilometer bicycle ride across a sand desert up into the Tibetan Plateau, and then finishing with a fun section. It's the longest downhill stretch of road anywhere in the world, from Lhasa and the Forbidden City there down to Kathmandu, Nepal. So the bike ride is just packed with challenges and obstacles, crossing 5 of the biggest mountain ranges in the world, bicycling days up to 160, 170 miles a day, and it's really going to be something.
Your wife, Kate, is accompanying you on this trip, along with your 2-year-old son, James, is that right?
Yeah, they are here. We just finally got it. We shipped a container of equipment over here and just unpacked a bunch of boxes of diapers and wet wipes and things like that. We were running low, so yeah, we are having a lot of fun with James.
What does 2-year-old James think of this? Does he have any idea what his dad is up to?
You know, he's just so excited because as a little kid, you know, swimming is his favorite thing to do too, so it just seems perfectly natural that there would be all this attention and excitement about swimming because that's what he's excited about too. And, you know, he knows Daddy's swimming in the River Thames, and he knows that, you know, I swam to France. And tonight I got home, and I asked him if he wanted to go to France tomorrow, and he said, yeah. And he went up to where his toys were stored, and he started putting all his toys in his bag because he knows he gets to travel tomorrow. So he's really soaking it up. He's having a great time.
What has surprised you most about the trip so far, where your expectations have met the reality of these challenges?
Boy, I think the thing that's the most difficult is just the mental side of this. Physically, you know, I've trained literally all my life for this expedition, but mentally it's very day by day. It's very difficult to swim for 8 or 10 or 12 hours and come home exhausted and starving and just know that you have to get up and do it again the next day and the next day and the next day and the next day. I arrived in France after swimming the English Channel just literally exhausted and just beat up. And I got on the beach, and I was looking around to figure out if I had landed someplace that I could start the bike ride. It wasn't a celebratory moment because when I got there, I realized, you know, the next thing I have to do is do this bicycle ride 9,000 miles. So there will be celebration, but not for another 10 months.
Dr. John Quinn of Des Moines is with you, a physician from Des Moines. Do you have an agreement with him? If he says you trust, the trust is there, so that if he says, no more, Charlie. This is not going to work. You're in danger. You're risking your life here.
Yeah, we do have an agreement. And part of English Channel swimming is that I have to recognize that I'm putting myself in a position where I cannot make a good decision. And so I have to surround myself with a team of people that can make those decisions for me. And I basically give them the proper right to do that. So Dr. Quinn was there. He was part of a team of about 5 people. My dad was also on the boat and his wife. And so they knew. They had to watch for the symptoms, and they had to make decisions about whether or not it was safe for me to continue on.
Charlie Whitmack is my guest, if you just joined us. He's an Iowa explorer, a lecturer, an attorney, and he's attempting the World Triathlon. And he's over 10,000 miles, 13 nations, 11 months of traveling. And the trip also includes an educational curriculum for schools and maternal health project in Nepal. Give us the website where people can find out more about this and track your progress, Charlie.
It's theworldtri.com, and try as in triathlon, T-R-I, theworldtri.com. And we've got a couple of guys traveling with us, Brian Triplett from the Quad Cities and Andy Stoll from Iowa City. And they're documenting the expedition, making movies, short films, you know, using the written word and taking photos. And so it's really a lot of fun. So I really encourage people to come by and check it out. You know, the stories about James and about Katie and everybody else.
You created the World Tri to motivate and inspire children. It's meant to be an educational tool. What overall messages in particular did you want to get across to the youth of the world?
Well, the purpose of the Adventure Institute is to help children do 3 things. First, to be able to identify global issues. The second thing is to motivate and inspire them to overcome those issues. And the third thing is to help them develop the practical skills necessary to have success. So what we do with the World Triathlon is we try to collect inspirational stories for our young people. That's one reason we chose to start up in the River Thames. The River Thames was declared a dead river in the 1950s because it was so polluted. There was no aquatic life that was left surviving. Now, a group of environmentalists came together in London and throughout the UK, and they decided to save the river, and they've done it. And so while we were swimming through the River Thames, we experienced over 320 different types of aquatic life, including little baby seahorses, which are now there because these individuals came together and decided they want to make a difference with their world. So we've interviewed historians, we've interviewed environmentalists, and made a series of films that we'll be sharing with students across Iowa this fall to help these kids feel like they're empowered and hopefully make them realize that their stories are not already written.
Mm-hmm. And this gives us the story you just told about the River Thames gives us encouragement when we think about our Gulf waters and how they've been soiled.
You know, there's a lot of challenges, and it's really the reason Katie and I decided to take on this project at this point in our lives was just because, you know, after having James, we started to feel like, you know, maybe his story had already been written. Maybe we hadn't been good stewards and provided a plan for him that would allow him to achieve his dreams. But as we started looking around, you know, there are inspirational stories of success, and we wanted to be part of that. We wanted to help collect those stories and share them with our students.
Charlie Whitmack, so you're on this bike trip now. Well, then after that, we go back to your old nemesis, or do you not think of? Do you think
no,
of?
No.
You don't think of Everest as a nemesis.
Everest is like home court. That's as good as it gets.
Home court.
And Katie and I were laughing. You know, when you're getting to the point in your life where you're saying like, all we have left to do is swim the English Channel, or all we have left to do is climb Mount Everest. You know that you've got a big expedition, but I feel right at home on Everest. Although this year it's going to be a little bit different because I'm actually starting from sea level. Ordinarily on Everest, you fly into about 9,000 feet. You walk about 40 miles to the base camp, and then you begin the climb from there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm starting at sea level this time, I'll actually cover a distance of about 950 miles, working my way across a good portion of India and then most of the way across Nepal, and finally climbing up into the Himalayas, reaching the base camp, and then making my summit attempt from there. So it's gone from a 2.5-month expedition that it typically takes to climb Mount Everest to a little over 5 months that I'll be on that run section of the triathlon.
I'm just imagining all the people you're going to be meeting along the way. Has the media in Europe been interested in your work so far?
So, in the UK, it's incredible. I mean, this is a land of exploration, so people around here, they just really get it, and they love it, and they appreciate what we're doing. So it's been, you know, the BBC is the big news agency in the UK, and yeah, you know, we've been on the biggest radio shows and on the biggest news programs on the radio, and you know, the children know who we are. When we were swimming down the River Thames, they would come up and cheer us on at the banks, ask for autographs. There was a group of about 30 kids that got together one day and sang us songs and cheered and danced, and it's been everything. But there was one man one night after I got off the radio. He was in his apartment, and he realized he was just down the street from where we were doing a live broadcast, and so he didn't even put his shoes on. He ran down the street to get an autograph, and it turned out that he was the descendant of Captain Webb, who was the first person to have swum the English Channel.
Wow.
It's just been phenomenal. The people here have just been really hospitable and just incredibly welcoming.
My conversation from earlier this week with Charlie Whitmack, who after swimming the English Channel last Saturday, became the first American to complete what is known as the Peak and Pond. That's the name given to the task of climbing Mount Everest, which he did in 2003, and completing the Channel swim. Next, my conversation with Kevin Connolly. Connolly is a photographer who was born without legs. He writes about his experiences growing up in his memoir, Double Take. He recounts how people viewed him as he traveled the world on a skateboard. The amazing story of Kevin Connolly. That's next on The Exchange. Your Iowa Public Radio. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. With 2,800 Iowa soldiers preparing for deployment in Afghanistan, tomorrow on this program, we have a conversation with a man leading the troops into the Middle East, Iowa National Guard Colonel Ben Correll. We'll discuss the Iowa Guard's plan to work with Afghan soldiers to stabilize the region. Then, also on tomorrow's program, I talk with Iowa National Guard Chaplain Martha Kester, who is also preparing for deployment in Afghanistan. Chaplain Kester is the first female chaplain in the Iowa Guard. That's tomorrow on The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And now we listen back to a conversation I had last March with Kevin Connolly. From the moment he began to move, Kevin Connolly has seen the world from an amended perspective. Kevin was born in 1985 in Montana. He was also born without legs. Now in his mid-20s, Kevin has completed and won numerous awards in monoskiing at the X Games. He's also traveled the world on a skateboard, photographing people staring at him. In fact, his photo project, the Rolling Exhibition, was shown at the Smithsonian. I spoke with Kevin Connolly last March when he visited the Des Moines Public Library to discuss his memoir. I began my conversation with Kevin by asking about his competition in the then just completed X Games.
This would be my fifth time, and it was the last weekend of January, and the course that they set this year was just far more burly than anything else I'd seen. They had 16 guys selected, six dropped out, and then one broke a collarbone, another cracked some ribs, and I was unfortunate enough to fracture a vertebrae on my second day of practice. So it was a burly event.
So what is that feel like? Fracture a vertebrae. What is that feeling like now?
It's feeling fine now. To be honest, it happened during the second day of practice, so it's arguable that I was certainly skiing on it the rest of that week. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of so sore throughout my entire body from just, you know, abuse and stress and everything that it took a week for the pain to even, like, localize and me figure out what was going on.
Right.
But it's getting better now, eating ibuprofen like candy.
So what category do you ski in, Kevin?
It's called the Mono X, or the Mono Skier Cross. And the really cool thing to note is that I'm sure a lot of people have seen, especially, you know, with the ending of the Winter Olympics, have seen the skier cross course before, which is, you know, the one where people go down at the same time and they have to go around these gates, but it's mostly, you know, big jumps and kind of whoop-de-woo sort of things. We ride on the exact same course that those other athletes do. And so we had features ranging between 30 feet, and then the last one threw us out maybe 110 feet. And you have four mono skiers going down with various disabilities. Some are paraplegic, some don't have legs. It's just, you know, largely based on competence and skill on the course.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in a nutshell, is the event. It's kind of like a weird cross between like snowmobile racing, you know, with the big heavy machines we're running, and skier cross.
Double Take is the title of your new memoir. This is the first book you've written, isn't it, Kevin?
Yeah.
Well, you're 23. You haven't taken that long to write your first book. You're only 23 years old.
24.
24.
Hey, I got to fight for every year I can get now.
Fascinating memoir. I read it over the weekend. It took me a day. I was glued to it for an entire day. It's wonderful. Fascinating.
Well, thank you.
Fascinating to glimpse life through your eyes. What made you write it?
You know, it was one of those things where I was working on the photo series that kind of informed a lot of the book through my junior and senior year of college. And when I got out, I always had the intent to try and publish those photographs, but it was really my now editor and publisher. When I first met them, they really stood out to me apart from all the other people I'd met and you know, were able to convince me. They're like, you know, we understand what you're trying to say with this photo series, but ultimately you have more to say about that, your experiences in Montana, growing up with your family.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things inform your later life. And so, you know, it was my editor and my publisher, who were very generous with their time. They let me move out to New York and work in their office next to them, you know, all to try and make this thing happen, which, yeah, it was at a young age.
You start your memoir at the very beginning of your life with your birth and the reaction of your parents. Tell us about that, because it was through this project, through this writing project, I understand that you had to have an awkward, what you said was an awkward conversation about, Mom, Dad, how did you really feel when you saw your baby born and the baby had no legs?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that was largely the biggest hurdle that I faced when I was writing this book, was that, you know, a 24-year-old guy from Montana, or a 23-year-old guy from Montana at the time I was writing it, you know, you're not necessarily predisposed to just kind of throwing yourself emotionally out on the table. So, yeah, that was definitely the biggest hurdle. And, I mean, quite literally, that first couple pages of the first chapter when I'm calling my folks, I mean, that's exactly what's happening. I'm just on the phone going, all right, we just got to do this. And, you know, as I'm sure in the book it shows, you know, my folks, if there's one thing they are, it's incredibly open. And, you know, the more I got into it and the more I started to learn about my early life, you know, the easier it became to keep going and to, you know, open up more and more. It was definitely hard at first, though.
How did they characterize, I think you asked your mom, what it was like those first few moments of having a legless kid?
Yeah, she said, I think the line you're referring to was, she said, you were an exclamation point on a really tough couple of years, which in context was she just lost her father and her oldest sister to cancer. And I think my dad the day before had just been fired from his job at the lumber yard. And, you know, the next day, August 18th, when I was born, was also her birthday. So, you know, after all that and 24 hours later, you know, 24 hours of labor, I'm sorry, this legless kid pops out. I would imagine it'd be quite a shock for anybody, especially when you don't know, you know, the next 20 chapters of the story.
Right. Kevin, when do you first remember being aware that you were legless?
It's a good question. I would say, you know, it's always kind of been to varying degrees, but, and a lot of people don't necessarily believe this when I tell them, but, you know, I would say not until sixth grade or something.
Sixth grade.
And I think school dances really drove home the point more than anything else. But, you know, you got to keep in mind that prior to that, I was growing up in a reasonably small town in Montana. So, you know, you have this tiny community that, you know, once they acclimate to who you are, you know everybody, things are familiar. I think that I had a really normal childhood.
Hmm. So the stairs that you document in your photographic exhibition and in this book were not stairs that you would get. You got those once you got out of your hometown of Bozeman.
Absolutely. I actually grew up in Helena. Bozeman is where I went for school. I mean, they're kind of neighboring towns, so it's not that much of a difference. But, yeah, I mean, that's you're 100% right. It was my sophomore year of college when I went to study abroad in New Zealand for a year and kind of was really just out trekking on my own, and then went to Ukraine and Austria and a couple other places just to travel, that I really became exposed, you know, to the number of different reactions people had to me that didn't know me.
Let's back up a little bit, Kevin. Of course, after your birth, the big question your family had was, and you yourself later in life had, was why? What could we have done, you ask in the book, to have caused this? And this is a question, interestingly, that was written all over the faces of those you photographed later in life. Do you know the reason this happened?
No, it's totally sporadic. CDC doesn't have any stats on it or anything else. I mean, to have a kid that basically had his femurs, you know, not grow, so pelvis and everything is fine, and is otherwise a totally healthy baby is a really rare thing. Mm. One of the important things I'd like to note on that though is, you know, I think the talent that my folks really had, and the thing that was really important was that, you know, they really only maybe asked that question once. It wasn't a lingering conundrum or anything like that. You know, we were always very focused on, you know, the logistics and the present.
Right.
And that was, you know, that was a really successful model for us.
Well, you mentioned the logistics. You note in your book that your dad was a big fan of MacGyver, this TV series. If our listeners aren't sure or didn't live during the time of MacGyver, he's a guy who invented all kinds of things from household items. And this turned out to be a lucky thing for you that your dad loved MacGyver. Explain.
Well, you know, I think one of the other things to know, on top of, you know, my dad's infatuation with MacGyver and, you know, his whole interest with this show was, you know, this guy's ability to build, you know, pretty innovative things that were immediately necessary using kind of nothing but, you know, whatever you could find laying around. Coming from Montana, not necessarily being around, you know, large hospitals all the time and really leading a rural lifestyle, that, you know, very much fit into our ethos of, you know, what we wanted or, you know, how they wanted to raise me. So, you know, he was watching that for tips on, you know, effectively kind of how to retrofit the house for me without necessarily diving into prosthetics or a wheelchair. So, you know, his MacGyverisms were, you know, installing simple stuff, keeping me from falling in the toilet when I was like 2 years old by cutting a smaller hole on the lid, installing a lower handlebar on the stairs. Probably the best, though, I think, was the invention of the butt shoe, which really just came about from the fact that, you know, in Montana, with all the snow that's on the ground and how much time we spent camping and outdoors every summer, a wheelchair just wouldn't cut it. So from my earliest memory, I just ran around on my hands. I don't think I even saw a wheelchair until I was 10 years old.
Now, I feel, this is an incredibly funny memoir. I was laughing out loud many times while reading it, Kevin. But I also had this nagging feeling that I don't know if I should be laughing out loud or laughing at all. For instance, your line, you mentioned the toilet seat that your dad said was his personal favorite of the invention for you. He said, "Dad said it was great because he didn't have to pull me out of the john in the middle of the night." Now, there's a great laugh line, but is it all right to laugh?
I think you should totally laugh.
Totally laugh? It's all right? Okay, I'll let it out. A big belly.
It's pretty funny. We've always had a really dark sense of humor, and, you know, my dad is kind of a foul-mouthed guy, or comes across as a little foul-mouthed in the book. And, you know, he's way worse, you know, than he comes across on the page, you know. And a lot of that just stems from our ability to kind of laugh at everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that goes hand-in-hand with what I was saying earlier with, you know, not asking the why me question for all that long.
Yeah.
You know, I think that some of that early stuff, writing about the things that were difficult for me as a kid, was tough to write at the time. Just, you know, basically to say, yeah, I fell in the toilet when I was 2 years old as a rough and tumble dude in his mid-20s. That was tough. But no, I think it was all meant to be approached with a good amount of humor.
Initially, you had artificial limbs, courtesy of the Shriners Hospital. Mm-hmm. By the end of third grade, you had given up these prosthetic legs. Why?
You know, I think that the key thing to in your mind's eye, if you're thinking about this legless guy, the key thing to remember is that I didn't have stumps, right? So there was no femur or anything like that, which is effectively how you would naturally create like a bipedal gait, you know, how most people walk. Since I didn't have that, it was kind of like this just big bucket that you would try your best to swing these gangly stilts. I mean, they looked like legs. They had shoes, jeans, everything else. But, you know, weighing in at 30 pounds and, you know, being, you know, these heavy kind of gangly things that were actually bigger than you in reality, made for really awkward movement. You know, I could run on my hands about 4 or 5 times faster than I could, you know, jump in these legs and try and for the purpose of looking normal. So, you know, the question that I think I posed in the book was, you know, how long would you be willing to wear stilts in order to look like everybody else? And I mean, the reality is we're all pretty lazy. We'd give it up after a week.
You write in your book, Kevin, the wheelchair brought about the first realization that I was disabled. So these prosthetic legs didn't work. The wheelchair worked better. But you realized then first that you were disabled.
Yeah. You know, and I think that that's the really interesting thing. You know, what does a wheelchair connote in our time? And you know, I mean, you got to keep in mind that I grew up thinking that I was just short. I kind of knew that I was missing legs or a little slower than, say, my sisters. But, you know, running around on my hands, I always was really taught to view myself as whole. And, you know, jumping into a wheelchair, it was kind of, you know, this initial shock to my system of, well, this is, you know, what I always saw other people in the hospitals and stuff. You know, why am I all of a sudden in this thing? And, you know, it did. You're right. It was kind of this double-edged sword in that it provided assistance that, you know, really was necessary when you're changing classes and having to carry books and all that. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, on the other hand, it did kind of force me not necessarily to view myself in a different light, but to certainly grapple with it.
I found it fascinating to see how people reacted to the wheelchair because it really stands out what the wheelchair means. Because
Absolutely. The
skateboard became your favorite mode of transportation. And let's get it straight here. You can book on this thing in the city, right?
Yeah, I mean, I can go about as fast as a cyclist in the city. I mean, I can in New York, when I was writing the book, I mean, I could make it from, you know, Grand Central to the Lower East Side in 25 minutes, 20 minutes. I mean, you can cover a ton of ground. To comment more on the difference of those two things, you know, I really took to the longboard because that was, you know, my thing. I love the immediate and, you know, the logistics and the practicality of that mode of transport. But I think that, you know, riding on the skateboard for me, which was, you know, purely a logistic reason, for others really carried a lot of maybe mixed messages around the world. I mean, when I'm in a wheelchair, I get far less attention than when I'm on a skateboard, ironically enough.
It raises, you point out in the book, it raises a lot of questions like, why is he riding that thing? Can't he afford a wheelchair? Is this guy homeless?
Exactly. And I think that, you know, we've been maybe not taught, but quite possibly conditioned to think, oh, you're disabled, you get in a wheelchair. That's, you know, the social script you follow. And I just never really had any interest in that and didn't really realize the full extent of the disruption that I might cause until, you know, I was kind of out in the world.
Now, some of the darkest humor in your book is when you were 17 years old, your description of your involvement in the, is it the vigilante parade in downtown Helena?
Yeah, yeah, the vigilante parade.
Do you dare tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, it's the first thing to note is that, you know, the floats are entirely by high schoolers. So that should give you – it's not a Macy's Day Parade. Let's put it that way.
Right.
All these high school kids are given a day or two off from school to construct a parade float that has something to do, regardless of how tangential, to Montana's history. And the one that myself and some of my buddies picked was, you know, vaguely just frontier medicine, which is kind of, you know, a loose excuse to get to saw off a leg. So we made these, I guess you could put it in quotes, prosthetic legs, except, you know, unlike the fancy ones that Shriners made, these were made out of, you know, wood and a couple nails that we cobbled together. And then we lined up, shot some arrows into them, you know, fit these fake prosthetic legs onto me, threw me on the top of this gurney sort of thing, and started rolling through town. The important thing to note, though, was we had kind of a brainy kid on our side who was able to rig up this compressor and run these tubes up through my leg that shot blood, I think I want to say like 30 feet in the air. I mean, we pumped a good, I forget the exact quote of the number of gallons, but I know it was like three times the amount that the human body can hold. But yeah, no, it was. We had a number of buckets of blood under the table, just shooting out and just covering everybody.
So what do you remember about the faces you saw of the onlookers at that parade?
Well, I mean, this is the thing: is that, like, on the one hand, you know, that sounds really gory and darkly, you know, pretty dark. But you know, there's something, I don't know what the deal is. I can't comment on the general mental state of most Helenans, but you know, they all thought it was pretty funny. The majority of people that I saw were laughing. I did catch by the end of it, there were a couple old guys who gave us some nasty looks for what we were doing. But I think the majority were all right.
And at the end of that chapter, you apologize to the people of the town because you certainly ruined a good number of clothes.
Yeah, that was one of the things I forgot to mention. Well, we were searching how to concoct this, you know, blood thing, or, you know, all these gallons of blood, and we had to figure out a way to just make this as cheap as possible. And so we went to, I think, the local Walmart or whatever, and we're looking for different kinds of dye. And by far and away, the cheapest was RIT clothing dye.
Right.
And with the amount that we had to create, that's what we ended up buying. And I will say, though, because I did put myself up on the chopping block in, as kind of an apology. I had a reading in Helena about that, and it was maybe 200 or 300 people showed up, and I actually read that chapter. So the apology, to my credit, was given in person.
Right. Maybe some of the people in the audience who had to throw away some clothes were actually
there. Yeah, I was expecting, like, you know, a coffee cup or something to get thrown in my direction, but no, nothing.
Kevin, some of the most heart-wrenching moments I found in your book are your accounts in the elementary school age, where kids actually don't hide it the way adults try to, but they say what's on their minds. They don't hide their reactions. An encounter with a bunch of kids at a McDonald's playground, for instance, a fight with a boy named Trevor in your school playground. What, for you, stands out as a sort of a really painful incident for you?
You know, I think a harder one, you know, aside from being called different or you know, getting beat up on, which is bad, but not, I don't think, all that necessarily unique. Certainly not having legs is unique, but I think that unfortunately is the treatment that a lot of other people have gotten. I think the thing that was really painful for me was actually the other part of that chapter when I was getting denied trying to ask this girl out. Mm. You know, especially early on, you know, when you're kind of playing the dating game in middle school, which is, you know, more of a farce than anything else, you know, it's super, super shallow. So you're just striking out left and right. And I know I'm kind of putting a bit of gloss on that. But yeah, I think realizing that I was different in the eyes of girls just at the time when I was becoming interested in them was probably one of the harder parts of growing up.
Also, you wanted to play sports mainly to fit in. But you realized that some sports were just out of the question, football or basketball. But you thought theoretically, before trying it out, wrestling might work because of your advantage. You had tremendous upper body strength compared to the other kids, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean that was the idea. You're running around on your arms. Ostensibly, you're going to be good on the mat. But one of the things that I failed to take into account was, you know, leverage. And it doesn't really matter how strong you are. I mean, if someone can tower over you and kind of plop themselves down on you, you know, I've heard of a couple guys without legs who are have done much better for themselves. So I could have just been terrible as well.
But you did just discover your sport, skiing, mono skiing.
Yeah, actually, it was the year that I was quitting wrestling, or just kind of getting in the midst of trying to eke out the end of the season. I think I was taken out for my first time on the hill, and it was just a once-off thing. But I was immediately hooked, and the next year kind of enrolled, not full-time, but was coming down every week. And, yeah, I just really, really fell in love with it. As to why, I think it was just, you know, I got to go fast and hang out with a lot of guys called dirtbags who were just kind of cool, roughneck, older construction guys who were ski bums.
Kevin, this has been wonderful. I want to thank you very much for this conversation. It's been a real delight.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much as well.
That's a conversation I had last March with Kevin Connolly. From the moment he began to move, Kevin has seen the world from an amended perspective. Kevin was born without legs. Kevin has also completed and won numerous awards in mono skiing at the X Games. He's also traveled the world on a skateboard, photographing people, staring at him. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Lindsay Moon, technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.